Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/AOIS21.
Welcome to It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker and a production of the AS21 Podcast Network, brought to you by AS21 Audio. This podcast is available on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and audio.as21.com.
If you'll forgive yet another very pompous thing to do in this very pompous podcast, I'd like to begin by dedicating this episode to the memory of Morgan Tsvangirai, the longtime and seemingly fearless leader of a democratic opposition in Zimbabwe to Robert Mugabe, who spent his life trying to find a democratic and liberal way forward for his country while being thwarted at every turn by a psychopathic and fanatical tyrant as its leader, who imprisoned him, beat him, tortured him, tried to kill him, and only to die of colon cancer at the moment Zimbabwe's tyrant fell, and he should have been the leader to take the nation into its new dawn. For 4 years toward the end, Mugabe was even forced to appoint Tsvangirai his prime minister. Inevitably, Tsvangirai was charged with selling out the opposition he led. But what else can an effective advocate for change do except for advocate for change within the order that already exists? What creates more equitable distribution is not the weakening or toppling of the system, but the strengthening of it. If you don't like the government under which you live, become a part of it, because the most effective means to change how we're governed is to change it from within. And for all the conservative harping about how much they hate government, American conservatives clearly understand this 1,000 times better than progressives do. After 30 years under Mugabe, inflation in Zimbabwe became 500 billion% per year. Yes, you heard that correctly. While Mugabe, who has preached Marxism and Leninism his entire political career, stole $2 billion in diamond revenues, built and acquired unknown quantities of mansions and luxury goods. Mugabe is said to live in a mansion with 25 bedrooms, drives a Rolls Royce that is supposedly an edition of 18 ever made, and his wife has gone on shopping sprees in Paris that cost as much as $75,000, and that doesn't even cover the wealth of Mugabe's cronies. Tsvangirai convinced Mugabe to adopt the dollar as Zimbabwe's currency, and the economy grew 10% per year. When Mugabe threw him out so as to enable Mugabe's wife, Grace Mugabe, to be his designated heir, the economy collapsed yet again, and the relative freedom Tsvangirai brought had finally relaxed Mugabe's grip to the point that the country was able to rebel and place Mugabe under house arrest. Tsvangirai was not a saint. He deliberately sabotaged the opposition within his own party, occasionally violently, but a saint is something an effective politician can never be. And the more brutal the surroundings, the more brutal a politician has to be to survive. How many politicians have ever been canny enough to ever be able to openly challenge a dictator, change the dictatorship from within, affect the dictator's overthrow, and still be able to die in his own bed? Tsvangirai will hopefully be remembered as the true father of his nation, and while Mugabe technically outlives him, his legacy will hopefully disappear as soon as possible. So before we go any further with the Eric Hoffer quote we started last week, I think I have to quote him slightly out of order to talk about Hoffer's exceptions to mass movements, those moments, not many of them, but hugely consequential when done correctly, when mass movements can be harnessed for good, just so we can understand right away that these mass movements of ours may, not will, but may, eventually have a very beneficial outcome. I'm sure you understand at this point that I'm cynical about it, but I'm willing to concede that it's certainly possible. But in each of these cases, when mass movements have been beneficial, there is a leader who directs them. It's in the nature of bottom-up movements that their benefits can be snapped up all the easier by people with power. A mass movement is too chaotic to not eventually cohere behind a single leader, because once the scale is tipped to a single flank of the movement, no other flank is yet powerful enough to stop them, or usually him. And the more leaderless and democratic a mass movement seems, the more it usually seems to cohere eventually behind a single leader, and once it does, it's at the leader's mercy. Whether that leader aims for the good of the people for whom he or she speaks, or for the good of his or her own glory, it's something that cannot be controlled by its followers once the leader takes its reins. So here is Hoffer. There are, of course, rare leaders such as Lincoln, Gandhi, even FDR, Churchill, and Nehru. They did not hesitate to harness man's hungers and fears to weld a following and make it zealous unto death in the service of a holy cause, but unlike a Hitler, a Stalin, or even a Luther and a Calvin, they are not tempted to use the slime of frustrated souls as mortar in the building of a new world. The self-confidence of these rare leaders is derived from and blended with their faith in humanity, for they know that no one can be honorable unless he honors mankind. Let's start unpacking this with a side note. To include Winston Churchill in 2018 among this band of great leaders is an extraordinarily controversial opinion. Churchill's reputation took a huge dive in our era, given both his extreme imperialism and his lionization by Bush-era neoconservatives. So nobody should deny that to call Churchill one of the world's greatest leaders is, in some ways, an extremely problematic claim. But ask yourself, if the urge toward conservatism is always going to be with us, no matter how badly we want to curb its most reactionary excesses, and I certainly believe that the evidence shows that it will, what kind of conservatism do you want to help foster among people who will always believe in it? Do you want right-wingers who excuse the authoritarianism of the right because at least it's right-wing, or that looks at the authoritarianism of the right and says, absolutely not? Racism will always be with us. So would you rather have racists who believe it's acceptable to treat supposedly inferior races in any and all manner of inhumane ways, or racists who believe that civilization demands that you treat people ruled with at least some level of decency? The latter is the kind of conservative that you want as an opponent, a voice that demands respect for tradition and cautions against change that's too fast. It's the kind of conservatism that has fundamentally died in America. And as I've said before, the closest national figures we have in our era to those who practice that form of conservatism is the Clintons. It's all well and good for a person of the left to say, I don't want any kind of conservatism or any kind of racism. But that's not an option. And every time you write conservatives off as the enemy, you leave them to their own devices and leave their worst urges to fester. Whatever one thinks of George W. Bush, and ideologically, I think he's clearly an authoritarian reactionary rather than a conservative. There is a reason that the Obamas have made an enormous show of embracing the Bushes. The Bush administration was far beyond the pale of any kind of conservatism that is good for America. But in showing a united front against Trump, the Obamas, and yes, the Clintons too, have shown how American liberals can embrace conservatives and even try to influence them to come around to less reactionary views. The True Believer was written in 1951, and since then, you would have to, at very least, add Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela to the list, maybe even Barack Obama too, and possibly people like the Hispanic American labor leader, Cesar Chavez, or Alice Paul, who for 50 years headed the National Women's Party, which fundamentally was the organization that secured American women the right to vote and inclusion of women as a protected group under the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Or the Czech leader Václav Havel, or even Lech Walesa, another name that would make liberals distinctly uncomfortable if they ever remembered who he was. You can look him up. Or even David Ben-Gurion. There is a second uncomfortable truth to which this leads us. It's one thing for leaders like Lincoln or FDR to use violent means. They were staring into the abyss of a world that was headed for war anyway, and turning that war machine into something that can restructure humanity for the better. But when you have leaders like Gandhi, MLK, who have no backing of the state, or Nelson Mandela, who did not have the backing of the state until the war was over, I'm sure you see where I'm going with this. If you were to ask, in a vacuum, whether an oppressed group is morally justified in taking up violent means to overthrow their oppressors, no matter where or when, the answer would have to be, of course. It would be repugnant to deny them that. But moral justification has never been an effective calculus to overthrow any power at all. To say that violent resistance is an effective means to empower the disempowered is to pretend the disempowered are less trapped than they are. It would seem that history has consigned the world to live through an infinite series of class wars in which every revolutionary movement thinks that it's the one to have cracked the code that stops the most violent and self-aggrandizing revolutionaries from rising to the top during the chaos of warfare. Which brings us to the next part of the Hoffer quote. and I quote, "When the moment is right, only a fanatic can hatch a genuine mass movement. Without him, the disaffection engendered by militant men of words remains undirected and can vent itself only in pointless and easily suppressed disorders. Without him, the initiated reforms, even when drastic, leave the old way of life unchanged, and any change in government usually amounts to no more than a transfer of power from one set of men to another. Without him, there can perhaps be no beginning. When the old order begins to fall apart, many of the vociferous men of words who prayed so long for the day are in a funk. Their first glimpse of the face of anarchy frightens them out of their wits. They forget all they said about the poor simple folk and run for the help to strong men of action, princes, generals, administrators, bankers, landowners, who know how to deal with the rabble and how to stem the tide of chaos. Not so the fanatic. Chaos is his element. When the old order begins to crack, he wades in with all his might and recklessness to blow the whole hated present to high heaven. He glories in the sight of a world coming to a sudden end. To hell with reforms. All that already exists is rubbish, and there is no sense in reforming rubbish. He justifies his will to anarchy with the plausible assertion that there can be no beginning so long as the old clutters the landscape. He shoves aside the frightened men of words, if they are still around, though he continues to extol their doctrines and mouth their slogans. He alone knows the innermost craving of the masses in action, the craving for communion, the mustering of the host, for the dissolution of cursed individuality in the majesty and grandeur of a mighty whole. Posterity is king, and woe to those inside and outside the movement who hug and hang on to the present." End quote. After every unsuccessful mass movement, and unsuccessful is what the vast majority of them are, you hear the same litany. That it didn't need to go wrong, that the good intentions of the original inspirers were perverted, that the reforms never went far enough, that this or that potential leader would have made a success of where the actual leader failed. Well, perhaps there's a 1 to 5% chance that one or more of these claims might have a bit of truth to them, even though we all dismiss such historical counterfactuals whenever it suits our viewpoints. But there is still the problem of systemic chaos. It doesn't take a genius to see that the system in which we live vastly favors certain people over others. But because the system already vastly favors people from certain groups over other groups, the people who are already in favored positions are in a much better position to protect themselves in the chaos that follows the overthrow of a system. So let's just think of a tale of two neighbors. Southern Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, and South Africa. The most famous leaders of both countries were long-term prisoners, though Mugabe only, quote-unquote, for 11 years in comparison to Nelson Mandela's 27. Mugabe was a violent revolutionary before he became the, quote-unquote, president of Zimbabwe, and he never changed his tune. After Mugabe's release from prison in 75, his army forcibly seized farms owned by white families. Roughly 30,000 died in this semi-war. And after he'd seized power, he outright killed another 20,000 citizens. He'd criminalized anyone who had the scientific education to make the land arable, which inevitably caused famine and extreme hyperinflation. With leftist dictators of various stripes, people inevitably like to point out widespread healthcare and literacy, but what's the point of healthcare when you don't have enough to eat? And how can you prove either actually exists when you have a political system that falsifies everything else? The point is that when a militant leader says that violence is the way forward, he generally means what he says. Violence is an addiction like any other addiction, and once you open its many doors of chaos, you don't choose which doors you walk through. The path chooses you. So here's Hoffer again. Quote, "Whence come the fanatics? Mostly from the ranks of the non-creative men of words. The most significant division between men of words is between those who find fulfillment in creative work and those who cannot. The creative man of words, no matter how bitterly he may criticize and deride the existing order, is actually attached to the present. His passion is to reform and not to destroy. When the mass movement remains wholly in his keeping, he turns it into a mild air. The reforms he initiates are of the surface, and life goes on without a sudden break. But such a development is possible only when the anarchic action of the masses does not come into play, either because the old order abdicates without a struggle, or because the man of words allies himself with strong men of action the moment chaos threatens to break loose. When the struggle with the old order is bitter and chaotic and victory can be won only by utmost unity and self-sacrifice, the creative man of words is usually shoved aside and management of affairs falls into the hands of the non-creative men of words, the eternal misfits and the fanatical condemners of the present. The man who wants to write a great book, paint a great picture, create an architectural masterpiece, become a great scientist, and knows that never in all eternity will he be able to realize this, his innermost desire, can find no peace in a stable social order, old or new. He sees his life as irrevocably spoiled and the world perpetually out of joint. He feels at home only in a state of chaos. Even when he submits to or imposes an iron discipline, he is but submitting to or shaping the indispensable instrument for attaining a state of eternal flux, eternal becoming. Only when engaged in change does he have a sense of freedom and the feeling that he is growing and developing. It is because he can never be reconciled with himself that he fears finality and a fixed order of things. Marat, Robespierre, Lenin, Mussolini, and Hitler are all examples of fanatics arising from the ranks of non-creative men of words. Peter Viereck points out that most of the Nazi bigwigs had artistic and literary ambitions which they could not realize. Hitler tried painting and architecture, Goebbels, drama, the novel, and poetry, Rosenberg, architecture and philosophy, von Schirach, poetry, Funk, music, Streicher, painting. Almost all were failures, not only by the vulgar criterion of success, but by their own artistic criteria. Their artistic and literary ambitions were originally far deeper than political ambitions and were integral parts of their personalities. The creative man of words is ill at ease with the atmosphere of an active movement. He feels that its whirl and passion sap his creative energies. So long as he is conscious of the creative flow within him, he will not find fulfillment in leading millions and winning victories. The result is that once the movement starts rolling, he either retires voluntarily or is pushed aside. Moreover, since the genuine man of words can never wholeheartedly and for long suppress his critical faculty, he is inevitably cast in the role of the heretic. Thus, unless the creative man of words stifles the newborn movement by allying himself with the practical men of action, or unless he dies at the right moment, he is likely to end up either a shunned recluse, or in exile, or facing a firing squad. End quote. There is no better example of the non-creative man of words, perhaps in all history, than Robert Mugabe, whom, for all the shallowness of his luxuries and the ineffectiveness of his policy, is described by everyone who meets him as ferociously intelligent and, if anything, rather quiet and bookish. He has 7 university degrees, 4 of them obtained from the University of London through correspondence while in prison. In some ways, Mugabe's path is the exact reverse of Mandela's. In his youth, he was a teacher with degrees in English literature and history, whose only political loyalty was to the nonviolence of Mahatma Gandhi. It was only in his mid-30s that Mugabe became a committed militant Leninist. When you hear Mugabe in interviews, he comes across as a leader as thoughtful as any in the history of the world. It's only when you realize what Mugabe has put his tremendous abilities towards that you realize the damage that a seemingly great man can do. Ta-Nehisi Coates has noted with annoyance how often white pundits compare Mugabe and Mandela as though to say that tyranny is something which Africans are uniquely tempted to embrace. Well, are African leaders and subjects uniquely tempted to embrace tyranny? Of course not. But the tyrannical circumstances in which many European powers left their former colonies certainly does facilitate potential tyrants in the wake of white tyranny more easily. The point of my comparing Mugabe to Mandela is certainly not to say that Africans are uniquely suited for despotism. It is rather to say that African history has something to teach America at this point in time rather than the other way around. The point of comparing them is also not to compare a saint to a devil, quite the opposite. Mandela was far from the saint he's often made out to be. Part of his great achievement is not because he forswore vengeance, but because he eventually renounced it. His career as a leader was begun by his break with African National Congress leaders who promised nonviolence to create a terrorist wing of the Congress. After he was imprisoned, Amnesty International never listed him as a political prisoner because he was so clearly involved in well over 100 acts of terror to which he proudly pled guilty when indicted and captured. From behind bars, he sanctioned a car bomb in 1983. He suggested cutting the noses of black South Africans who were suspected collaborators with apartheid. And the African National Congress ran a camp in Angola in which they literally tortured and burned suspected black collaborators to death. Mandela was an ally of Castro, of Arafat, and of Gaddafi. But what made Mandela extraordinary was not his advocacy of social change or of nonviolence, but his gradual relinquishing of violence when he realized that nonviolence was more practical. His attitude was always that nonviolence is a good policy when the conditions permit. As the world began to pay more attention to South African apartheid, Mandela began to move further and further away from his violent positions, and in many ways, what made the world pay more and more attention to South Africa was Mandela's gradual renunciation of violence to begin with. Mandela was much more important than a saint. He was a practical leader who reacted to the changing conditions of every moment. Even at his most violent, Mandela was a far cry from Mugabe, because the violent acts sanctioned by Mandela were specific, limited, and targeted. Mugabe, on the other hand, deliberately instigated indiscriminate riots to implement a full-scale civil war in the late 70s, which alone is enough to prove Martin Luther King wrong when he said that rioting is the language of the unheard. More on that in a few minutes. What made Mandela great was not his means, but his ends. The end result was, as he put it in the 1964 trial that resulted in his imprisonment until 1990, a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. And he proved that he meant it. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission meant that there would be a public record of who did what, both white and black, but also that no matter what people did, there would be a second chance without retribution. Mandela was a Marxist to the end, but he refused to nationalize South Africa's industries, and corporations pumped money by the billions into the South African economy. All the same, South Africa is quite far from great these days, in some ways still worse for South Africans than under apartheid, who are apparently murdered at a crime rate of 50 a day, with a disproportionate number of victims being black. The unemployment rate occasionally goes above 30% and never below 20%. And we won't touch the statistics about sex crime in South Africa. We'll just say that it's an enormous problem and mention that 5.7 million South Africans have HIV, no less than 12% of the country. Meanwhile, a million white South Africans have left, and the South African government no longer puts much stop to black terrorist organizations which requisition farms away from white families through murder and arson. But this is Africa, upon whose backs all manner of modern European greatness was created, forced to struggle day by day in their agonizingly slow climb from a status of mass enslavement to their taking of the rightful honored place among the nations. The fact that the tensions of South Africa could be as fraught as anywhere in Africa, yet avoid the kind of apocalypse that befell Zimbabwe, or Somalia, or Sudan, or Ethiopia, or Rwanda, or Nigeria, or worst of all, the Congo, has to be counted an unambiguous triumph. The country muddles through, lives another day, fights the good fight against a world structured to cause their failure. And since we're already on South Africa, we could go down a very long rabbit hole and talk for episodes at a time about Gandhi, who people forget spent the first half of his career there. I'm sure Gandhi will come up in future episodes, perhaps many times. But the reason to mention Gandhi at all is to emphasize how different a figure he was to Mandela. The historical figure Mandela resembles far more, and I'm sure this comparison will drive a number of listeners crazy for completely opposite reasons, is David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel and the most powerful Zionist for a full half century. Both Mandela and Ben-Gurion were pragmatic socialists ready to give up their supposed principles at the first sign that they could create advantages for their constituents. They were willing to make peace and reconcile with their enemies as often as they were to visit violence. In their wake, both of these deeply compromised men created great, vital, democratic societies that, in spite of extraordinary flaws, survived from one era to the next, comprised of peoplehoods who had every reason to expect that the world would hand them the same suffering handed to their peoplehoods elsewhere. Through a combination of olive branches and violent strikes that were reactive to the still greater violence visited upon them, it was their combination of vision and tactical skill that created nations built to last. Would, however, either of their nations have less problems had the tactics of their leaders been still more selective in their violence? Well, the world will never know. And that brings us to Martin Luther King, who now seems to be all things to all people. There has, in recent years, been a serious push on the left to reclaim him as an agitating, discomforting force. It's not hard to understand why or to sympathize. In an age when Martin Luther King gets lip service paid by the same old racists who in their youths wished for his death, he's embraced by the right as a comforting force whose agitation has nothing to do with violence, should be considered a scandal. Yes, Martin Luther King was an agitating force in American life who aggressively pushed Americans to realize all manner of inequalities, racial, legal, and financial, that, properly applied, would still be an incredibly uncomfortable message to the vast majority of Americans. He is now taken up, though, by people who refuse to renounce the validity of inflicting violence as a specifically political tactic. And to claim that MLK would do the same is a revisionist history of a revisionist history. It's true. MLK said in response to urban riots that rioting is the language of the unheard. And even if that's not necessarily true, Mugabe, among many other examples, proved that riots can always be directed by richer and more powerful people toward the objects of rage they sanction. It's not completely untrue either. But even so, supporting the reasons why people riot should never be confused with the support and encouragement of directed acts of inflicted violence for political means, which MLK never gave any indication of supporting. Furthermore, depending on your point of view, King's method was, if anything, violent toward African Americans rather than white Americans. Moderates decried Dr. King as a fanatic. They decried King's willingness to allow children to march and therefore be subject to police brutality, and so, by the way, did Malcolm X. After the Civil Rights Act, when Dr. King switched much of his focus to poverty and the Vietnam War, he was decried by Republicans as a communist. And yet, today, he's seen as the epitome of American nonviolence. Reality, as ever, is more complicated than we ever want to admit, but the concrete reality is that the only people King ever directed violence towards were his own marchers. You could never say with any certainty that, to take one of the most common accusations, Black Lives Matter endorses political violence, and that would be so completely outside the mainstream of what it stands for that it would be almost offensive to suggest it. And yet it wouldn't be completely offensive either. Black Lives Matter is deliberately a much larger, perhaps unwieldy, political movement than itself. When people speak about BLM, they often don't know to which organization they're speaking. They may or may not be speaking specifically about BLM, but instead the Movement for Black Lives, which is the umbrella organization for the campaign which all the groups under BLM protest. They might be speaking of Campaign Zero, a movement for police reform. They might even be speaking about the National Anthem protests. If these people are particularly sloppy in their thinking, they might even be speaking about Antifa, the even more nebulous conglomeration of extreme protest groups worldwide whose tactics are not limited to breaking windows and throwing Molotov cocktails, or 20 other more minor protest groups. All of these movements are related, but they're far from the same. And therein lies the spirit of our times in which the wings of inclusion spread so wide that it's just assumed that anything noxious which inclusion picks up along the way will be so watered down by all the other elements that the noxiousness will simply dissolve. And that's a big and very risky wager not backed up by the trajectory of similarly inclusive movements in the past. All you have to do is to take a quick glance at the trajectory of 19th century socialist movements to see where that ends up in the long term. Whether it's been Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter, or Me Too, there is a deliberate looseness to all these non-presidential mass movements in the name of inclusion. But as a result of it, the flanks within them have to distinguish themselves to become noticed. Therefore, the more extreme of any flank within it, the more noticed it becomes, and the more widespread a chance the rhetoric has for adaptation. And when poisonous ideas get the cover of good intentions, it becomes still easier for people to adapt to concepts they would otherwise see as ideological poison. More on that in future episodes. So here is the final part of this 2-week-long Hoffer quote. Quote, "The danger of the fanatic to the development of a movement is that he cannot settle down. Once victory has been won and the new order begins to crystallize, the fanatic becomes an element of strain and disruption. The taste for strong feeling drives him on to search for mysteries yet to be revealed and secret doors yet to be opened. He keeps groping for extremes. Thus, on the morrow of victory, most mass movements find themselves in the grip of dissension. The ardor which yesterday found an outlet in a life and death struggle with external enemies now vents itself in violent disputes and clash of factions. Hatred has become a habit. With no more outside enemies to destroy, the fanatics make enemies of one another. Hitler, himself a fanatic, could diagnose with precision the state of mind of the fanatics who plotted against him within the ranks of the National Socialist Party. In his order to the newly appointed chief of the SA after the purge of Röhm in 1934, he speaks of those who will not settle down. Without realizing that they have found in nihilism their ultimate confession of faith, their unrest and disquietude can find satisfaction only in some conspiratorial activity of the mind, in perpetually plotting the disintegration of whatever the setup of the moment happens to be. As was often the case with Hitler, his accusations against antagonists inside and outside the Reich were a self-revelation. He, too, particularly in his last days, found in nihilism his ultimate philosophy and valediction. If allowed to have their own way, the fanatics may split a movement into schism and heresies which threaten its existence. Even when the fanatics do not breed dissension, they can still wreck the movement by driving it to attempt the impossible. Only the entrance of a practical man of action can save the achievements of the movement. So has there really been truly ideological poison in BLM or Me Too that we can even mention them in the same minute of airtime as Nazis? Of course not. A comparison like that is absolutely revolting. And if either movement has any true danger about it, it has yet to even present itself in the slightest, which is not to say that it won't. The point is not that the goals of Black Lives Matter or Me Too have any aim that is in any sense objectionable, but if the history of radical movements is any guide, then the idealistic drive for radical inclusion can easily prove to be their downfall. And the more success such movements achieve, the more likely they may find that their victories are a poisoned chalice. The world is what it is, and every solution creates its own new problems. In just 3 years, the world has changed enormously, much more enormously than it changed in the first few years of the Obama presidency. I firmly believe that those who wish to see reform of the police or in how the sexes will relate to each other will eventually see some form of it come true. But in every societal metamorphosis, there are always unintended and completely unpredictable consequences, and we have no idea what they will be until they happen. As always, some places in the world will benefit enormously from the change, and some will suffer all the more because of it. Now, I've made so many bad oracular predictions over the years that I would like to keep my Cassandra urges to a minimum. But if history is any guide, then it seems to me that there will probably be many more movements in the next few decades in the spirit of these two mass movements of the left. Like Black Lives Matter and Me Too, they will take enormous pride in being leaderless, but eventually they will be in danger of coalescing all the more firmly around a singular leadership in just the same way the religious right coalesced around presidents like Reagan, Bush, and Trump. Neither Reagan, nor Bush, nor even Trump could ever be mentioned with the misdeeds 100 breaths away from Stalin or even a butcher 100th as bloody as Stalin. But liberals of the mid-century placed systemic limits on what they could implement. And the damage compared to what they wanted to do was very small indeed. A left-of-center president who works within the system, like a Kamala Harris or a Cory Booker, can build on the achievements of presidents like Obama and Roosevelt. But a Bernie Sanders or a Tulsi Gabbard likes the American system no more than Reagan or Trump does, and thanks to 50 years of Republican rule, will find the American way of life that much more easy to dismantle. Does this mean that a Bernie Sanders or even a Tulsi Gabbard or Keith Ellison would be anything like an absolute ruler? Of course not. But any mass movement which begins in America can always spread elsewhere, and once they do, what might seem benevolent at its first appearance can return later to the same country in severely malignant form. This is what happened in Russia with socialism, what happened in Germany with nationalism, what happened in America to a lesser extent with political Christianity, with militarism, and with unrestrained capitalism. If it can happen to one side of American life, it can happen just as easily to the other. And the more idealistic these movements become, the more blind they become to the mendacity of the people who accumulate power within them. And what begins with so much hope can blind them to the reality that monsters can cloak themselves in great idealism all the more easily. And in an era when fake news and fake facts can be manufactured with such ease, it's all the more easy to convince people who think they unassailably have right on their side that what's true is false and false is true. for the 40 years between Dr. King and President Obama, the battle for all manner of civil rights for all manner of groups coalesced around no one leader, and perhaps consequently, its gains since 1968 have been few and far between. In both cases, the leader called for pragmatism, and the subsequent gains were both enormous and enormously short of people's dreams. It's all too easy to learn all manner of wrong lessons from that. Every one of us may think we have bull detectors that are better than rabid Trump supporters have, but so does everyone in every era in history. Once idealistic radical movements coalesce around a singular figure, as they eventually do in every place and every era, we had all better hope that they coalesce around a Mandela rather than a Mugabe. And most people who want to lead mass movements are Mugabes. If and when such a thing happens, we will know which type of leader he or she is very quickly. And everyone with high hopes and higher ideals just might curse the day they ever started us down this path.
Much of what happened, what is discovered now, will of course be secret. We will not be given the full answer.
This has been It's Not Even Past, A History of the Distant Present, hosted by Evan Tucker. This has been a production of the AS21 Podcast Network and brought to you by AS21 Audio. Find this and other episodes on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and our home on the web, audio.as21.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/itsnoteven past. That's it for this episode, but we'll be back, because the past isn't dead, it's not even past.
Hey, listeners, we need your help. We here at AS21 want to know what you think about your favorite podcasts on our network. Like what you're hearing? Want to hear more? Want to hear less? Who would win a fight, Keith or Silby? Visit your favorite podcast page or surveys.as21.com anytime before February 28th, and you'll get a coupon for 21% off everything in the AS21 market. Again, that's surveys.as21.com.
Copyright 2018, AS21 Media, LLC. All rights reserved. AS21 Media. What do you want your story to be?